Thank you. If I were a minstrel, I'd sing you six love songs to tell the whole world of the love that we share. If I were a merchant, I'd bring you six diamonds with six blood-red roses for my love to wear. If I were a nobleman, I'd bring you six palaces, with 600 servants for comfort and care. But I'm a simple man, a poor common farmer. So take my six ribbons to tie back your hair, yellow and brown, blue as the sky, red as my blood, green as your eyes. Six ribbons to tie back your hair. I'm not exactly sure where you'd even put six ribbons in a woman's hair, but I guess it doesn't really matter, does it? Because it's the thought that counts. And it's kind of a beautiful image, isn't it, of a man's love for his woman. And we all know that he's not really a minstrel or a merchant or a nobleman. You see, there's no real confusion, is there, about who he's claiming to be. After all, this is a song. It's not history. It's not a description of reality, but rather a description of how he feels. It's evocative. It's creative, emotive, poetry. It's song. He's not a minstrel. He's not a merchant. He's not a nobleman. Just a poor common farmer with a heart full of love. In fact, actually, in one sense, he's not even a poor common farmer, and he actually is a minstrel, depending on whether you're talking about the person who wrote the song, because that's what a minstrel is, a singer-songwriter, or the main character of the song. But either way, no one's confused, are they? No one's deceived. After all, it's a song. Not a newspaper report or a history textbook. And so I'd suggest it is with this wonderful book known as The Song of Songs, which we're going to be diving into over this weekend. Now, sadly, it's probably one of the more neglected books in the Bible. I'm curious, before this weekend, who had actually read The Song of Songs? Hands up if you'd read it. Yeah, so a bit less than half, yeah. Sadly, it's one of the more neglected books in the Bible, which I personally think is a bit strange because I don't know about you guys, but I love intimacy. Sex and passion excite me, as does love, and that was even before I was married. These things held a great fascination for me, and this book is the place to go if you're interested in those things. But whatever the reason for the neglect of the Song of Songs, whatever the problem, we can be sure, can't we, as Francis explained earlier, that these words are meant for our teaching. They're meant for our rebuking, for our correcting and our training in righteousness. You see, Song of Songs is nothing less than the Word of God. And so we need to hear it, for it will equip us for every good work. But having said that, we do need to understand how it works. We need to understand what it is, and that is namely a song. It's a love song. In fact, as you see there in verse 1, excuse me, it is the Song of Songs. Do you know what that means? Remember when the Bible talks about the King of Kings or the Holy of Holies? It's a way of saying this is the Song of Songs. It's the greatest song of them all. It's the masterpiece of his age. So think of it like, I was made for loving you. Or I would walk 500 miles or La Macarena or Gangnam Style. Top of the charts of the bullet. You'll notice I referred to no songs in the last 20 years, no love songs, because there haven't been no good love songs in the last 20 years. Have they, Jean? See, but notice it's not just the Song of Songs, it is Solomon's Song of Songs. And that could mean it's for Solomon. It's like a gift in his honour, or perhaps even as a corrective to his legacy when it comes to love. So it's his song in the sense that it's for him. But the other option, of course, is that it's actually by him. After all, according to 1 Kings 4:32, he did write 1,005 songs. And so maybe this is one of them. But even so, even if he did write it, it's clearly not in the plain sense of the word about Solomon, is it? It's not a retelling of his love life. And we know that because if you remember anything about Solomon, he had how many wives? 700 and 300 girlfriends, concubines. And that is a world away from what we find in the Song of Songs. Okay, so it's clearly not about his life, even if he did write it. The other thing to say is, again, we do need to read the material as a song. And so if there's a little bit of jumping around between the characters, a little bit of confusion about the sequence of events, well, that's okay, isn't it? After all, it's a song. I don't know if you've ever kind of examined song lyrics for songs today, but nothing's changed, has it? They're evocative, they're fragments of feeling, they're episodic flashes, they're not carefully recorded narratives. So let's dive in. So can I get somebody from the floor, just where you are, to read that first paragraph, let him kiss me. Someone from the floor read that, please. Thank you.
Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than mine. Breathing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. Take me away with you, let us hope, let the king bring you into his chambers.
Thanks, Rach. And so we're introduced to the woman. The woman, beloved, bride, she, woman. I mean, depending on what your version of the Bible, they will have all these little headings or titles to introduce parts of the song. Now, these titles aren't actually in the original text. They're kind of a reader's guide in order to give some idea of who's speaking. But here we have she starting the book. She also ends the book, and frankly, she dominates the book. So she's the main character. She speaks 53% of the time compared to the man's 39%. Now, that could be that, like most women, she has a far greater ability to communicate and share her feelings than your average bloke. It's said on average that women use 15,000 more words each day than a man does. I reckon most men run out at about lunchtime. Explains the stereotype, doesn't it? A long day of work, what do men usually want to do when they get home? They don't want to talk. So his wife will want to talk and share feelings, and fair enough too, but he will usually just want to collapse for a while in silence, have a sleep, watch TV, play on the computer, potter around in his shed before he's ready to become verbal again. So it could be that just kind of that men-women thing, but it could also be something about this woman in particular. See, she's the kind of woman you just can't help admiring. She's so free and liberated. She's passionate, she's got desires, and she's willing to communicate them to the man she loves. And isn't it glorious that she does? And isn't it attractive? Isn't it inviting? Isn't it wonderfully appropriate for a godly woman to be like this? See, she wants to be kissed, verse 2, deeply, passionately, repeatedly. She wants to drink deeply of love and intimacy with her man, as wine flows gently over lips and teeth, as wine is sweet and warm to the taste, as wine can make your heart glad and leave you giddy and dizzy and out of control. So that's what his love and kisses are like. That is what desire can be like. But better than wine, more powerful than wine, more dangerous than wine. Notice verse 3, that he smells good to her. That is something that most of us blokes need to hear. I grew up with two brothers, no sisters. We were definitely a toilet seat up household. And it took me about 15 years of marriage to finally start to pick up some of these subtle nuances. Maybe you don't know, but women have a far stronger sense of smell than men. Did you know that? It's true. Apparently my wife Jean tells me that BO and stale sweat doesn't do it for her. Who'd have thought it? Incredible, isn't it, that she could not find me always attractive. And as to the stuff here about colognes, I don't think he's saying, the song is saying that you have to become a metrosexual going around wearing David Beckham or Hugo Boss, because in less hygienic times, cologne was used to cover up some of the more unpleasant smells. Nonetheless, brothers, perhaps in general, you could aim to use a little water occasionally to wash off the sweat. Apparently there are these things called showers, for those of you who are non-connoisseurs of the bath. There's also these recent inventions called soap and deodorant that might be worth experimenting with from time to time. You hearing me, blokes? He smells good, but his name or reputation is an even bigger turn on, verse 3. See, it's not all about sleazy pickup lines. And there's nothing wrong with a man getting himself into shape, dressing well, but if you really want to be attractive to a woman, what you need to do is win her respect. Have you noticed how women nearly always marry older? Nearly always. There's no rule that says they have to. And in fact, given that men die younger than women, it would make sense for them to marry younger so they can, you know, spend their whole lives together. But they don't. Generally speaking, they marry older. Why? Well, because they want to marry a man they can respect. That's the logic, I think. So do the maths, blokes. Become a man who deserves respect. Become a man with a good reputation. Become a man who can and who will lead. Am I the only one who's noticed how most men are nowhere near as attractive as their wives and girlfriends? Am I the only one who's noticed that? Why is that so? See, why did my wife Jean marry someone who looks like me? I can only assume it had something to do with my character. So not so much the shape of my body, but the shape of my reputation. She loves and desires a man, doesn't she? She wants him to know, and she makes her wishes pretty clear, doesn't she? In verse 4, she's eager for consummation to their love. She wants to enjoy with him all that love and intimacy and desire have to give. She wants him to make love to her, and it's great, isn't it? Within the right context. She's passionate and free, full of desire for the one she loves. But what about the man? Well, according to verse 4 and verse 12, he appears to be the king, which has led some to think, well, maybe this is about Solomon after all. Except, according to verses 7 to 8, this man also appears to be a shepherd. And as you know, Solomon was no shepherd. It's true, his father David was a shepherd and a king, but he was never both at the same time, as this man appears to be. If I were a merchant, I'd bring you 6 diamonds with 6 blood red roses for my love to wear. He's not really a merchant. He's not really a king. She's not describing what job he has, but how she feels. You see, to her, her lover is a king. And she, his princess. He's her alpha male, you might say. Her warrior king. And isn't it great? I don't want to give away any secrets. Jean has forbidden that. But at home, it's just like that between us as well. I'm her Chris Hemsworth, her Wolverine. Now, she's not confused about my identity. See, it's a godly fantasy. It's how she celebrates me and honours me in her heart. Verse 4. Picking it up in that, is it the second paragraph? We rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine. So we've met the man and the woman, and now we meet her friends. Most women have a strong network of relationships, if you notice that, and they're kind of like a sounding board for her, giving her perspective and advice about this love that she's pursuing. She also gives them advice about what lies ahead when their time for love should come. And there's a sense in which, as readers, we stand in the place of her friends, seeking to learn the lessons that she and he can pass along. And on this occasion, notice what the friends say? Big, what emoji? Big thumbs up, hey? Thumbs up. They celebrate her, the fine choice that she's made. They encourage her, go for it, girl. See, love can be so intoxicating, so bewildering, that it's really important to get advice from those you trust. And that's obviously true for both single men and for single women. But single women in particular need to be very careful if friends and family don't respect the man you love. I mean, they know you better than anyone. Who's in a better position to give you good advice than your family and your friends? It's been said that when you date a girl, you date her friends and family as well. I've got to admit, I wish I'd realised that 30 years ago when I first met Jean. I would have made far less mistakes than I did. But it's true, blokes. You actually need to impress those around her and not just her. Because they, if they care about her, they would tell her exactly what they think of you. Make sense? Let's read on. Next paragraph. Can somebody read how right they are to the end of verse 7, please? Someone read that for us, please.
Yep, I read it.
Thank you.
How right they are to adore you. Dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. Dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyard. My own vineyard I have neglected. Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends?
Thanks, Jess. Passionate and free and wonderful, but she's no beauty queen. She doesn't look like the cover on the magazines. It's kind of comforting to know, isn't it, that women in Solomon's days were just as self-conscious and full of insecurities about their appearance. Perhaps it's the widespread admiration of a lover has made her doubt herself a little. And maybe she wonders if she's good enough for him. Perhaps she's worried about how she can compete with all the other local beauties. And so you hear this kind of cry of pain here, don't you? This, she doesn't want others to look at her. She doesn't even want her friends to look at her, verse 6. Why? Because she's too dark by the standards of the day. It's interesting, isn't it? How those who are come from the east, who have darker skin, they all want to have lighter skin, but those of us who grow up in the west, what do we all want to have? Darker skin, don't we? And it's usually about economics, because if you're wealthy enough, then you can either cover up and keep yourself pale, or else you can go to the solarium and work on your tan. At this point, she appears to be unmarried, since she's under her brother's care, verse 6. We can only assume there's no dad, because a dad never occurs throughout the book. And notice she feels a little bit of resentment, doesn't she, towards her brothers. Because instead of protecting her and providing for her as they should, she's been forced out to work alone and to work hard in the family vineyard. And all this to the detriment of her own vineyard, which is, of course, a metaphor for what? Anyone guess? What's her vineyard? Yes?
Her self-confidence and her faith in herself and her beauty, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think you're on the right track. Yeah, I think she's certainly talking about her attractions, her beauty, her appearance, and her body especially. Yeah, at this point. Fantastic, Cassie. But despite all these doubts and insecurities about herself, she longs to see her lover. Perhaps she wants a tender word of reassurance. Perhaps she wants love, since it's in such short supply among the men in her life, her brothers. If only she and her lover could meet. But where and how in a way that's appropriate, sheltered from the scorn of others. Let's pick it up at verse 9. Now, that paragraph, please. Someone read that for us. 9 to 11. Yes. Hank, you're happy to read that for us?
Yeah.
Thank you, Hank. Thank you very much, Hank. Appreciate that. Notice here she gets her reassurance, doesn't she? Although, if you're looking for tips, you probably don't want to simply cut and paste, blokes. Tell your love that she looks like a horse. Again, you've got to remember this is Solomon's song, so it's either by him or for him. And Solomon, we know, was a real lover of horses, so you can see where the imagery is coming from, can't you? He had 12,000 horses, according to 1 Kings 10:26. I guess, again, if we were updating it and the song was being written for me or by me, instead of likening my love to a horse, what would I liken my love to? A football player, Patrick Cripps, or some other majestic Carlton player. But here's a horsey bloke, and so that's the language we get. It's hard to be absolutely certain what he's saying. He could be saying she's like a glorious show horse, dressed in all her finery, ready to win first prize in dressage. Or perhaps, maybe he's actually saying she's like a mare. Do people know what a mare is? Female horse? yoked to a stallion's. you put a mare together with stallions. Can you guess what kind of disturbance might be created? So she's the one who creates a disturbance wherever she goes. She puts all the guys on heat. It could be that could be the language. I don't know. It's hard to be sure. But just a word. Notice the language of jewelry here. I don't know if that kind of gets you thinking, given other things the Bible has to say. Just a word about jewelry and adornment. You see, he thinks it's really clear as you read the song that he thinks she's stunning, as she is. But nonetheless, her beauty is enhanced by her earrings, her strings of jewels, her silver studs, her sense of fashion, the style of her hair, even her shoes in chapter 7, her makeup, if she's wearing any. You see, they all build and add to what is already a masterpiece and bring it to completion. You see, there's nothing wrong with a woman enjoying how she looks and seeking to enhance it. There's nothing wrong with braided hair and with jewellery. There's nothing even wrong with expensive clothes. As far as I can tell, for having a wife and a daughter, all women's clothing is expensive, isn't it? It's ridiculous. See, when the New Testament speaks against such things, it's not actually contradicting what we have here. It's saying there's a better and a greater beauty. It's the beauty of the heart and behaviour of a gentle and quiet spirit. It's the kind of beauty that actually increases with age. How good is that? Increases with age. Mature, godly Christian women are actually far more attractive than those at their physical peak, but not their spiritual peak. But again, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with enjoying physical outer beauty while it lasts. It is a gift from God. There are greater gifts, but nonetheless, it's still a gift from God. See, theirs is a love that is more than skin deep. They seem to know each other's heart and mind as well as their bodies. Repeatedly, he calls her sister throughout the book. So she's a lover, but she's also like family because she's his closest companion. See, it's more than skin deep, but it's not less. See, he loves her skin, her beauty. She excites him and he excites her. Let's pick it up and go from 12 to 17, 12 to the end. A volunteer, please, 12 to the end. Thanks, Katie.
While the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. My beloved to me is a sachet of myrrh, resting between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of Ben Gedi. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes are doves. How handsome you are, my beloved. Oh, how charming. And our bed is verdant. The beams of our house are cedars, our rafters are birds.
Thank you, Katie. So he is like a wild flower in a desert oasis, verse 14. In other words, he's a sight for sore eyes. He's like a cold drink to parch your thirst in a hot desert, that kind of idea. He's also sweet-smelling, lying between her breasts, because that's what she longs for, verse 13. She imagines what it would be like to sit down for breakfast with her lover, her king, and to draw him in and seduce him, verse 12. He loves her eyes, verse 15. She loves their bed, verse 16. And he dreams of the day when they can escape and flee to the country and be alone with none to see and roll around in the hay, verse 17. See, it's heady and powerful stuff, isn't it? This love they share and their desire to explore it, to enjoy it and consummate, so long as it's in the right context. It's a very powerful and open and honest and positive view of love and sexuality. We'll have questions at the end, if that's all right, Cassie. Yep. It's a very positive view, isn't it? And it's not just here. We see the same really positive view in other places, like in Proverbs 5 as well. And yet, you know, Christians are often accused of being anti-sex. The world will say that we're afraid of love and sex and intimacy, that we're against pleasure. They will say that we try and turn something that is natural and good into something that is dirty and sinful. And I think they've got a point. I think they do have a point. Maybe it's been an overreaction to the sinful, sex-obsessed cultures that Christians have lived in. But sometimes I think Christians have had an overly negative view of sex. Let me give you some examples from history. By as early as the 2nd century AD, many Christian leaders believed that sex was always tempted, or was always tainted by sin. Always. So, for example, Tertullian believed that the extinction of the human race would be better than to have to continue humanity by means of sex. That's slightly negative, isn't it? View of sex. In the 3rd century, Origen took the teaching of Jesus literally. If your right eye causes your sin, gouge out and throw it away. And so he castrated himself to be rid of sexual desire once and for all. According to the Council of Nicaea, you might have heard of that because some of our churches, we say the Nicene Creed. But according to the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century, anyone who believed that Song of Songs was about sex should be excommunicated by the church and would be eternally condemned by God. I've got a problem if they're right. I'm going to burn. Not long after this, Gregory of Nyssa, another famous early church leader, he was teaching that Adam and Eve were created without sexual desires, and if the fall had not occurred, they would have reproduced not by having sex, but by eating fruit from one of the trees in the garden. Some kind of pollination, I'm guessing. And even Augustine, who truly is one of the great Christian leaders, he taught that sex within marriage was okay. Okay, so long as there was no passion or desire involved. I don't know if you know much about sex, but I'm not quite sure how that's meant to work. You know, but there you have it. In the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church made it compulsory for all priests to be celibate. After all, if the priests were meant to set an example of godliness to everybody else, then clearly that wouldn't be possible if they were married and having sex. And if you're weak enough and you capitulated and you got married, then sex was only allowed for procreation, producing babies, and not for pleasure, which is part of why Catholics still today aren't meant to use contraception. Do you see how it is? It's all just so far away, isn't it? It's worlds away from the Song of Songs. You've got to wonder what our main character, the woman, would have made of it all. She doesn't just want his baby. She wants him body, heart and soul. There's no shame here, no embarrassment, just an unabashed celebration of love and pleasure, romance and sex, desire and intimacy. Whatever hang-ups we might have, the Bible is very clear that love and sex and romance are wonderful things. There's nothing dirty or disgusting about them. And given our history of suggesting otherwise, we're probably going to have to make a special effort to convince the world otherwise. Ask any unbeliever, what's the Christian view of sex? They will tell you it's a negative view. We're going to need to work hard, aren't we, to shout it loud and to shout it strong. Shout it often. That the Bible teaches that sex is wonderful. Intimacy and love and desire are really good things. Personally, I still can't figure out why every second Christian wedding doesn't have a talk from the Song of Songs. I mean, it just seems the natural fit. But we always choose passages that have got nothing to do with marriage instead of the Song of Songs. Makes no sense. I mean, how else are we going to convince those around us that we do believe in these things? See, love is good, intimacy is great, sex is fantastic, and so says the God who designed us. I mean, what do you think they were doing in the Garden of Eden when they weren't gardening? Remember, they were naked, there were no barriers, there was no shame, there was just sheer unadulterated delight. What do you think they were doing? The man is so excited by it, he sings a little song. I don't know if you know, men don't naturally burst into song unless they're really genuinely excited. Surely they were enjoying and exploring God's good creation. And I presume that would have included each other. See, you guys may not look quite so fine as me. I'm sorry. But that doesn't mean you need to be embarrassed by your body and how it works. and the sensations that you feel. It's all part of God's wonderful design. And that is one of the unmistakable messages from the Song of Songs. Don't you know that God created breasts and genitals? He made our bodies. He invented the orgasm. He created us with the ability to enjoy touch and taste, smell and pleasure. The Apostle Paul goes so far as to call sex between a husband and his wife a holy act of obedience to God, as well as a loving act of service to your partner. You see, love is good, sex is good, romance and intimacy and pleasure are good in the right context. And of course, the right context is marriage. So there's not a lot said about the status or situation of the two lovebirds in the book. We're not told explicitly whether they're simply interested strangers staring each other over their smartphones on the train. Or maybe they're on their first date, or maybe they've kind of gone up a level and they're now special friends, as you young people like to call it. Maybe they're engaged, betrothed, married. See, because nothing's actually explicitly said, it can raise some interesting questions. I mean, should they be saying that, doing that, wanting that? And perhaps that's why Christians are being scared off from reading and teaching this book from God. But right at the centre of the book, something very important takes place. And when I say at the centre of the book, I mean the exact centre. You see, if you set aside the title verse, chapter 1, verse 1, then chapter 5, verse 1 lies at the very centre of the book of Song of Songs. There are 111 lines that come before it and 111 lines that come after it. That's no accident. What do we see in chapter 5, verse 1? What do we see right at the centre of the book? We see the consummation of a marriage. See, it's brilliant, isn't it? The song insists that love and sex, romance and intimacy are great, but only in the right context. And the right context is, of course, marriage. And that's something the rest of the Bible confirms again and again. Love and sex, romance and intimacy are wonderful, but only in the context of public promises and lifelong commitment. Because only in such a context can trust really operate as it should. Only in such a context can true and total nakedness both work and bloom. See, it's hard enough convincing our fellow Christians about this, let alone the world, but we do need to keep saying it. Love is good. Intimacy is good. Sex is fantastic. But they belong in marriage. And so they must belong in marriage. And until you get to that point, does anyone know what the famous message is of the Song of Songs? If you've read it before, there's a kind of a refrain that's repeated throughout the book at key intervals. Does anyone know what it is? Indeed it is. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. In other words, hold your horses. Statistically speaking, 93% of you will get married at some stage. But even if you haven't yet, you're allowed to be excited about love. You're allowed to pray for love. It's okay to search for love, but do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Hold your horses until the time for love is ripe. That is, until you're ready to actually get married. But more about that in our next session late this afternoon. So I'm going to pray and then we'll move on. Let's pray. Dear Father, thank you for a chance to be introduced to the Song of Songs and its wonderful and unabashed celebration of the goodness of love and sex and intimacy and desire within the context of marriage. Help us to believe that and help us to speak that way to the world around us. Help us, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Now,